Hello, everyone, and welcome to Teach Me Teacher, a podcast for educators where we, the teachers, become students ourselves. I'm your host, Jacob Chastain, and today I am talking with my partner in crime, Marcia Smithy, about learning from your experiences, becoming a teacher at a late age, and doing everything under the sun. How are we doing today?
I'm excited it's Friday.
I know. That's how every episode starts, because we podcast on a Friday.
Everybody's excited this Friday. No, it's kind of surreal to be here after listening to you interview everybody else. You know I've been resisting this.
You're in the hot seat, as they say.
It doesn't feel quite as hot as I thought it would feel.
That's good.
Yes.
There are... that got me thinking, because you always talk about Friday. Do you follow any teacher things on Facebook? Like teacher pages?
No, I just follow some guy that's pretty funny that's always in his car.
Yeah, oh.
That guy's funny. Okay, that's
there's
it.
There's a couple guys like that now.
Yeah.
But I always just say that because there's always those memes that come up, like on Wednesday. Is it Friday yet? Is it Friday? I like Friday. Friday's fun for fun lessons.
Yes.
I don't want to get off on a tangent, but that's, today. I'm high on my lesson today.
You had so much fun. You had a good one.
So much fun.
It's good.
Anyway, I have you here because, one, you're my partner in crime, so I talk to you every day, and every day I tell you you're going to be on the podcast.
And every day I've been telling you I'm not ready yet.
It's okay, but now you are.
Well, we'll see at the end if I'm ready.
You'll be ready by the end, maybe. Really what I want to talk about with you is, because the thing that comes up all the time is your experiences as a teacher, because you've had experiences from all over the place, in different venues, in different situations, and also the path that you came to become a teacher and how that's affected how you treat our kids and how you treat your fellow colleagues, including me and everyone. And they're really, to put it simply, I mean, they're experiences I think people can learn from, and I think you have a lot to say. So to start off the episode, I just want you to tell us a little bit, get us to know who you are. You know, there's people in this building who might not know your story, and there's definitely people listening to the podcast who they want to know who they're about to learn from. So tell us a little bit about who you are, where you came from, and how you became a teacher.
Okay. Well, I definitely am not the traditional teacher that graduated from college straight in my early 20s. I'm from Michigan, and I am the youngest of four kids. And grew up in a household where my parents were not college educated. My mom, however, was. She was an x-ray technician long before her time. She, in the 40s, 50s, she was a career woman, started out. So she was highly educated and continued educating herself. But really, I came from a family where there wasn't somebody really checking homework or trying to find out what we were doing. So as a result, I always say I was a whole lot of fun to sit by, but I wasn't a great student. I was fun to sit by in class, but I was that average kid. You know, I was just really kind of that average kid all through junior high and high school.
You know why? Like, why did you take up the...
There was really no expectation. There was no expectation in my household to pursue academic. Mm-hmm. You know, it was respectable, citizenship, kind, compassion. My parents taught me a lot of really amazing characteristics, but they were really busy surviving financially, too, so they weren't really... They didn't really, raise the bar for us for all four of us. We were all four late bloomers with college. And that's kind of where I come from. Amazing parents. Mm-hmm. But I just didn't grow up in a household of, college-educated folks who were, encouraging us all to pursue that. So,
yeah, you just kind of took up that, what high school, I mean, did you have any idea that, to go to college or...
Yeah, I wanted to go to college, and I went to college. I actually went away to college, to a Christian college, my first year. I went to Spring Arbor College in Jackson, Michigan, and very small school. Went away, but once again, I was not very academic at all, very average, and met a guy who was a senior, thought I was going to get married, and quit school, didn't go back the next year, went to a community college. But that kind of fell through, thank goodness, because I was only 19, but... Yeah, so I just, I always wanted to, but I was not the kid in high school who is in the pre-AP classes or, the AP classes.
Sure.
So I was just the average kid.
And then you jump, you go through your life, you have kids, you're a mom, you do all that stuff. And then, so what changes, 20 or so years down the line that made you go back to do the teaching thing?
Well, initially, I think I did have about, before I got married, I had about 30 some hours of classes. Mm-hmm. And then I always wanted to go to school. So I think initially when I had toddlers, I wanted to get out of the house. So I started taking a college class once in a while. But it literally took me about 20 years from the time that I graduated from high school in 77 and I got my bachelor's in 2003. So, you know, it was a long trek and a lot of different classes here and there, but it really accelerated when I moved to Texas in 1999. My then husband was coming with GM over here, and we moved over here, and I had the opportunity at UT Arlington, and I, you know, kind of stepped up the pace and took full-time classes, and I graduated in a couple years with a bachelor's in English.
That's so, pretty crazy.
Yeah, I was 43 years old at the time. So,
what was that like?
It was a lot of fun because, as you know, here I'm very, I'm kind of motherly and nurturing. So I was at school with a lot of young kids that, you know, thought I was a blast and was happy. They were always happy I had a cooler full of food in my strolling backpack. And, you know, hey, Marcia, do you have any Tylenol? I mean, it was just the same kind of thing here where I just kind of took care of folks while I was there. But there were people my age too. And I'm not a great student as far as, like, it doesn't come easy. So there were some long weekends writing papers, hanging out in the library. And I loved every minute of it. I loved it. You know, unfortunately, sometimes I look back and I think especially my youngest was a little bit neglected at times because I was so consumed with trying to get done and get the grades and write the papers. So, but it was an amazing experience. And I did the whole cap and gown thing, walked across the stage, everything. Neither one of my parents were there. My dad was not alive at the time. My mom couldn't travel, but my older sister came. And, I was pretty excited. I definitely did the whole hands in the air and, did this, graduated, walked. It was very surreal for me to think I was getting a bachelor's.
Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting to see the path that people took because I was the first one in my family that I know of, like, you know, my family that I know that ever went to college, and they, you know, I just kind of did it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I took some time off after high school, and then eventually I just kind of made my way through, and I was a terrible student. I tell these stories all the time. Like, I'm a terrible student. Like, it's not that I'm lazy, it's just that I'm a big procrastinator. Mm-hmm. And I really dive into the stuff I love, but if I'm taking a class that, you know, doesn't interest me that much, I definitely take, like, the back seat, you know, and just both in academically, I'm just like, all right, you know, just do the minimum to get there. Right. Did you have any of those moments?
Well,
were you, like, determined when you went back?
Well, I found that you know, it's kind of hard to talk about this without talking about my personal life as well, which is kind of a struggle. And certainly don't want to hurt anybody's feelings that might listen to this that loves me and knows me and his family. But first of all, I found that the older I got, I was a much better student. You know, my grades are better. Mm-hmm. I was paying for it, so I definitely wanted to do better. Nobody else was paying for it. But I became really excited about the fact that I could be successful and do it. And I'm the youngest of four. My brother didn't go to start college till probably he was almost 30, and he's a Harvard grad, you know. And my sister became a kindergarten teacher before I did. My oldest brother has a lot of college credit. I don't think he was far from bachelor's, but just never finished. So we were all kind of late bloomers, but it was pretty exciting. It was really, really exciting to get that done. And to have my mom know that I finished that was very exciting because my mom was still alive when I finished.
How quickly did you have a job as a teacher afterwards?
Well, I was alternative certification. I got a bachelor's in English, and I was doing a long-term sub job at Young Junior High in Arlington. And it's funny, it was a technology job. And I'll never forget that this kid, it was a long-term job, and this kid changed the scrolling on the front, the screen of the computer and put some obscenities on there about me. And the technology guy from the district happened to be in the building that day. And so when I told them that this was on there, you know, the AP came down with the APs and we nailed it right down to the exact time and which kid was sitting there and busted the kid. So it's pretty funny. That was my experience before I ever became a teacher. And, you know,
it's best to get that out early.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. So I was like, wow, okay, well, that's how it is. They just let you know. But then I actually, a position came up at that school, and I went to the principal, and Mary Cannon, and said, hey, I know you have this job, and I want to throw my hat in the ring. I'd love this position. And she said, well, let me think about it. And she came back to me and said, listen, I just can't. She didn't feel comfortable about going with the, this was 2003, with the alternative certification. Mm-hmm. And I had some amazing people go to bat for me. Pat Cooper was one of them. And say to her, what are you thinking? She's been subbing for us forever. She's great. Don't let her go. And so she literally came back to me and said, I'm going to take the advice of my teachers and I'm going to offer you this position. So it was pretty cool. And so when she got done talking to me, I said to her, is this for real? Can I like go call my mom now? And here I was 43 years old. She said, yeah, it's for real. And I specifically remember calling, going out into the courtyard and calling my mom and telling her, Mom, I'm a teacher. I got a job. I'm going to be a teacher. So
yeah,
pretty exciting.
That's incredible. I mean, what's interesting, I mean, you said 2003, right?
Yep.
So the alternative certified, when I was going to be, I didn't know what I wanted to do in college. I thought I wanted to do marketing or do something with my creative talents or whatever. And, you know, once I was working with corporations, like I kind of realized I hate that line of work. Like I hate trying to figure out margins and trying to figure out how to get profit and how to manipulate people to buy stuff. Like this wasn't my thing. I didn't really care. So I got alternatively certified too, but the world has changed. But I remember looking at forums like, you know, about alternatively certified, and a lot of the older ones on the web, on the internet, they would talk about how, you know, well, there's tons of teachers graduating from college that want to be teachers. So they're going to look at them before they look at alt certified. Right, right. But I feel like that's, you know, probably still true, because the way I got in the door was I knew the assistant principal here at the time. Well, actually, was she the assistant principal then? No, she was the academic coach.
Hammer?
Yeah, because she's an assistant principal now at a different school. There we go. Right. I finally figured it out. But, you know, she was my teacher in high school, and she was my foot in the door. And, you get hired because of who you are and whatnot. But that's interesting that you kind of went through the same process. So I know what that feels like to be like someone gives you that chance.
Right, right. Well, and the connection we have with her is when I interviewed here, she was in my interview. So she and Dr. Barty are the two that interviewed me and hired me for this position here. So it's probably kind of cool we have that connection. But anyway.
That's crazy. Yeah. But so you get hired. You're alt certified, freaking out, going in it. Well, so clarification. How long were you at that long-term sub position before you got the full-time
job? I was only there a month.
Oh, and,
but
man.
I had subbed through that whole year. Actually, okay. Probably about 2 years while I was going to UTA, mm-hmm. I subbed predominantly at that school.
Okay.
So I had built a reputation as a sub there.
Oh, that's cool.
And so that's what I tell people when they want to teach is start subbing and get in there and know what you want to do.
Well, it'll teach you if you want to do it or not
real quick. Yeah, it definitely will. Because when I did elementary, I said, no, thank you.
Yeah.
And so subbing's great for trying to really look at what it's like before you get into it.
Mm-hmm. Beginning, those first years, what were you teaching? Were you teaching English?
I was teaching English, 7th or 8th grade English. It changed a couple times. I was always on the writing side. And I was at Young Junior High 6 years, and they were surplusing 8 teachers. And I was safe. I wasn't going to be surplused.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like, I'm a spiritual person. I pray about things, and I kind of felt like there was a bigger picture that something else I needed to do. And so I went down to the principal at the time and said, hey, listen, I know I'm not going to be chosen to be surplus, but I want to volunteer. And he asked me, where do you want to go? And I said, I don't even care. I just want to throw my name in and wherever I end up. And all my friends told me, you're crazy. You are crazy. Do you know where you're going to end up in Arlington? Blah, blah, blah. And about a week before school, I'd started. I didn't know I had a position. And I called Kathy Baye, my friend that was my department head, and said, hey, can I have the bookcase that's blah, blah, blah in some room, you know? She said, you're not there. You're not at Young. You're going to be you got a different job. I don't even remember where it was, but you have a different job. So I looked at my email, my school email. It was summer, and I had a job at Barnett Junior High School. And so I was 6 years at Young, and then I moved over to Barnett, didn't know a soul, and it's a Title I school, which Young Junior High was not at the time. I don't think it is now either. But it was a totally different culture and atmosphere. And it just gave me a whole new journey and adventure that was just incredible. So that's how I ended up at Barnett Junior High in Arlington.
Let's talk about that journey, right? Because these, you know, you tell stories, you know, about some of your experiences and whatnot. So what was the difference, the main difference from going from this one school to the next?
One of the things, obviously, there was a lot more diversity among staff and students at Barnett Junior High. So that was very new to me. But I didn't fear it at all. I embraced it. You know, my own kids are Mexican. We don't even say Hispanic. I know Texans say Hispanic, but my kids are very proud to be Mexican. And
your personal kids, just for clarification.
My own kids that I gave birth to, yes. Yeah. So there's a very high Hispanic population there, African-American population, Asian, and, you know. So it was very diverse. And so dove in, I just got in there and I just absolutely loved it. I was there 6 years and I learned so many things. And one thing I did learn is that in any school environment, this school included, when you have a certain group of kids or a number of kids who are being disobedient or belligerent or have sad hearts and are just acting out, whatever the reason, sometimes it can seem like it represents the entire body of students, and it's absolutely untrue. It's a very, very, very small percentage, but they're very loud, and I mean that metaphorically.
Yeah. You know?
I grew to love those kids a lot, and even the kids that were some of the toughest kids, you know, that were those acting out kids, I got along very well with them. Had a lot of fun at that place. And the only reason I left, I got married. After 4 years of being there and living in Arlington, I got married, and I was then making the hike from Arlington to North Richland Hills every day, and it just got, you know, I'm just getting too old to give anybody 2 hours a day driving. So it was very sad, and it was very scary, and a big risk for me to apply for a whole different district, especially as a teacher that's getting older. You know, I was scared about moving, and then they get rid of folks or whatever. But anyway, another step in my spiritual journey where I just really trusted what I felt like God was telling me to do.
Sure.
And so the adventure continued. I came here on a Thursday and Bartie hired me on the spot. I had an interview on a Thursday. And then 3 days later, it's a whole another story that we don't need to get into. But 3 days later, I ended up in the ER and ended up having to have a pacemaker put in. And so I actually missed the last 3 weeks of school of my last year at Barnett Junior High, which was sad. I didn't really get to, like, say goodbye to kids or anything. So, that was a little difficult. But I have some incredibly sweet colleague friendships, family, people that are from that place that I still am in touch with, and people that changed my life and changed my vision and changed my heart for different kids. And so, it's a very integral part of who I am as a teacher. And those people know who they are. Reuben, Z Green, you guys know who you are. There's so many of them over there that I love that I'm still in touch with. So,
and then you come here and the whole, you know, this is where the story, you know, that from what I've seen, you know, this part of the story is, where it's kind of, it seems like it's coming into fruition, and I mean, it might be just, you know, hindsight's 2020, of course, but like here, it seems like, you know, the skills that you were taking from those schools and those experiences that you're really like just throwing them all into this pot here, because you do a couple different things here now that you've been here. This is your second year, right?
Yes. Well, what's incredible was, I come from 24 years being married to someone who's in the Hispanic culture, having Mexican kids of my own, taking the language at UTA and still doing very poorly with it, but I try hard, having a very diverse school that I came from. And 2 years at Barnett, I was we had a position, star reading, and I worked with 7th and 8th grade kids who did not pass the star. I worked with what Miller calls what does she call them? Yes, you know.
We
know.
Reluctant
developing
readers.
Developing readers. She tries to, and I've always called them struggling readers. So basically, I worked with the kids, and I kind of watchdogged the data on those 7th and 8th grade kids at Barnett and whoever didn't pass or did better on their CBAs. But basically, I worked with kids that needed to read. And that's a real adjustment, because when you you know, at Young, we did well with our scores. And I was teaching writing, and my scores were always top, competitive with, you know, with the kids. But when you sign on to work with struggling readers, you know, I know you and I have talked about this before, ego needs to be checked, because it is not about who passed, because you're not, you know, basically you're not going to have a ton of kids that pass, but it's time to look at gains.
Yeah.
And so those couple years at Barnett prepared me for coming here, because when I got here, I started out with a writing position in one reading class, and halfway through the year, my principal, Mr. Whitfield, and Jennifer Young, who was the ESL coach for the district for our age level, suggested that I take on the ESL position they were beginning at this school. And at the time, I wasn't even ESL certified. But they had given me a PSYOP class, and they liked what I did with that, and so they were encouraging me and offered me that. And they told me I had till October to get certified, but I was not going to have them begin a year not knowing that I was certified. So spring break last year, when I had that class, second semester, they created an ESL class and gave you my reading kids, as you well know. I got certified. And so, but that's just the beginning of the journey. I mean, I am learning so much about how to work with those kids. But I do have the experience behind me of the reading, the developing or struggling readers, the, you know, different cultures, the diversity. So, I mean, it is incredible to me to be the age that I am and be at this point in my career and be absolutely at a pivotal, like, exciting, whole new part to my career by working with the ESL kids. And
yeah, I mean, it seems, I mean, just from someone who kind of sits on the outside, you know, looking in, is it seems like you've, you know, you found your forte. You found, like, in this little community of kids that you work with, you know, you have four or three classes.
I have two classes of ESL.
Okay.
I have sixth, seventh, and eighth grade in both of those classes. And what's new for me here is we have a very large Egyptian community here. Mm-hmm. I've never worked with kids that speak Arabic, so that's been really an incredible journey. And it's just, you know, it's like I have a heart for these kids that goes beyond, you know, when all the baloney and the chaos and the crazy talk about immigration and all the different things, these are my kids. And when I go in there and just shut the door to my classroom, I just love on these kids. And, you know, it's just, but it's those kids are the very real world people that are dealing with all the stuff that everybody's arguing about, you know, as far as immigration and citizenship and illegal immigrants, whatever. And I don't even care. What I care about is, you know, do you understand what you have to do in Coach Simmons' English class today? Or should we go over that, you know?
You know, you have a map, you know, in your room where y'all took time and, you know, found where everyone was from and whatnot.
Yes, right now I have students from Puerto Rico, Honduras, Mexico, and Egypt. I don't think I'm forgetting anybody. I can't think. Last year I had a kid from the Philippines. I had a kid from Spain. I mean, yeah, we have a very diverse group here.
So how do you approach this task of getting these dormant readers and these you know, the struggling readers and whatnot? How do you approach coming to them and not only, you know, trying to get them to, you know, up to standard, right? You know, we're a standards-based school, so in the background there's that, but how do you approach what you're doing in that room with all of these kids and all of these variations that you have to deal with? What's the mindset you're going in with?
Well, the very first thing that's important for me when I have those kids is to build a relationship with them. Mm-hmm. And they got to feel safe. They absolutely have to feel safe. And one of the things we talk about in the very beginning is, hey, we're all in the same boat. There's a level playing field here. What we're all struggling with is English, or we wouldn't be in this class. So nobody's better than or less than. So they're all, you know, they're all pretty much at that same spot. And I don't speak Arabic, and I speak Spanish very poorly. So there's so many different things and strategies that we do to communicate with each other. But, you know, I would say building the relationships is the biggest thing, getting their trust and having them understand that you're going to have to read out loud in your other classes. So no matter how poorly you feel you're doing it here, let's do it here where you're safe. So the relationship's got to be built first so that they're willing to do that. And the other thing is, like last year I had a mixture in my room. I learned so much about just the different cultures, but I had Muslim Egyptian kids and I had Christian. And there was an angst between those to groups that we had to absolutely eliminate for the classroom to be a community. So we had to go through that step where we all talked about, we're a community. Whatever goes on outside in the world, we're not even going to be, we're not going to have those same mentalities in here. In here, we're helping each other. We're working together. And it was powerful to see within weeks of how these kids were helping each other when before they were literally telling me, oh no, I'm not going to talk to them because they're Christian or I can't talk to them because they're Muslim. And so it was just really, really powerful to make them understand in here, we're just Smithy's kids. We're just, you know, we're a community and you will take up for each other on campus. You will take up for each other in this classroom, you know, because that's who we are. We're a community. So that was pretty powerful.
I mean, do you find that you, I mean, how do you think your class would go if you didn't spend so much time building those relationships, not only with you, with them, but with them, with each other? Like, do you think you would like, what would that even look like? Is it even possible?
You know, it's just who I am to build relationships. So I don't even know. That's just who I am. I build relationships, and people would tell you that. Everybody, anybody that knows me and loves me knows that I get close to people.
Yeah.
But what I do know that it looks like, what's incredible to me is, like, I posted a picture on our website one time, the Richland Middle School Facebook page, because I look up and somebody's struggling, and like three or four other kids are all around him helping him figure out what to do on whatever project or issue or assignment we were working on. And the fact that they celebrate each other's successes, you know, that's I don't even want to talk about what that doesn't look like, because that's what it looks like the majority of the time. You know, we're working together. We're trying to get stuff done. And sometimes they'll laugh at each other, and I have to scold them and get after them. I say I go granny on them, you know, but sometimes I have to say, hey, put yourself in check. Where were you 6 months ago with your language? You know, I don't hold back. I let them have it if they're getting on to each other or they're teasing each other. But we all recognize, and they will quickly admit, yes, I was lost. I felt lost. I didn't know any English. You can do this. And it's really pretty incredible to see them encourage each other.
Well, it's interesting. You know, the point that you said, you know, a little while ago was, you know, there was like some kids, you know, the ones that are in, you know, that are in pain and they act out in certain ways, or they're really lonely because of their home life and they act out in certain ways. You know, we all know those kids. Any teacher that's been in the classroom, you know those kids.
Absolutely.
And you might not know the reason, but you know there's a reason for why they do the things they do. And you said you can't focus on that, right? Like, they're really loud, and it feels like that's always right in your face when it's that one kid. I was wondering, from the ELL perspective, and from these mixed classrooms that you have, do you feel, is it the same way with the kids that, like, can't read? So you have all of these kids who are improving and whatnot, and then you have a small section that might, you know, that might be struggling a little bit more, or their test grades might be low. Is it really hard to look at the bigger picture and see all of the improvement, or like, do you just fixate on that, you know, not the negative side, but that the lower end? It's like, oh my God, these three have low scores, meaning, you know, meanwhile, the 12 others are getting better and whatnot. Is that the same type of thing?
You know, the thing is, it's funny you asked this, because even Monday I had a meltdown in my counselor's office, Kanata's office, and Will and I had a meltdown with you in PLC. I was just distraught over scores, data scores of CBAs, and, you know, with the ELL kids, and was quickly reminded by my counselor and my administrator that, hey, I don't even want you to look at that stuff. What we're looking at is, what we constantly have to look at is gains and the relationships we're building and the realistic situation of how long it takes to acquire language. I mean, that's the thing we have to really look at. I started grad school. I've not finished. I haven't even been in classes for the last couple of years, but I'm about halfway through a master's as a reading specialist. And one of the biggest things we learned in there is that language acquisition takes a long time. You can't just rush it. But you know, it's frustrating, and it's not frustrating because of my ego. Like, I feel like I'm not good enough to be getting this done. I'm frustrated because I see kids who are lost. You know, I think of one little guy that literally, he was actually moved back to the newcomers, but he literally stood in my room and cried and said, I can't do this. I'm lost. I don't understand. I'll never speak. And I literally held the kid and we both cried. And I said, yes, you will. You will get this. You will get this, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I stress about those few kids, but, you know, we tutor, we have them work together. We just do the doggone best we can. And, you know, there could be other things going on too. When you have kids with language, they won't, we don't even look at, you know, sped needs or anything like that for 3 years. They have to be here a while to show that it's not a language issue, that it's something else. So, man, you just do the doggone best you can and, you know, hope for the best and try to communicate with their core teachers. So if there's something else we can do to help to, you know, get them coming along, you know.
You know, a couple themes that have come out of these episodes of Teach Me Teacher, and everyone who listens to it kind of hits on them too when they talk about it, is, you know, that relationship building piece. And for me and you specifically, you know, we started reading some literature, you know, at the end of last year in summer, you know, Donald Lynn Miller's work specifically affected both of us. But the big thing she talks about, you know, when she's working with readers and whatnot is that relationship piece, because in order to get them to read and trust you of what you recommend and to push them a little farther to get different literature in front of them, like you have to have that relationship piece. So my question to you is, you know, I feel like that was just natural for you, first of all, because we have already established, you know, you're a relationship person, you attach to people, you mother them and whatnot. But when it came to, you know, giving them the freedom to pick their books and read and do things like that, was that, you know, from a teacher and academic standpoint, was that awkward to start that process? Or how did you feel once you started freeing yourself up?
You know, it was scary. Okay, and to be clear, I have two classes that are ESL, mm-hmm. 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. And then I have 4 6th grade reading classes. So with the reading kids and the new philosophies, well, I don't know, they're not necessarily new, but it's new for us to
put in practice,
implement. Yeah, yeah. 15 minutes a class period when you have a 45 minute class period of reading, you know, silent reading time. First of all, it's very scary because you're not sure that it's really going to happen and our grade's going to get better, or our skills going to raise, or is it going to be a waste of time where everybody screams at you and says, hey, you just really threw this time away, you know? And second of all, some of the things in her books that talk about reading were challenging to myself. One was a relief. One is the ability to abandon a book. Even as an adult, I feel guilty if I start a book and I don't finish it.
Yeah.
But she teaches, look, if this book is boring, if you don't even look forward to reading it, get rid of it, you know? Yeah. So it was very exciting to me to introduce these philosophies to these kids, but it's very hard to build those relationships enough where I know what does a kid want to read? What would he like? Not only do I need to know the kid, but I have to know what literature's out there. And for me, that's a struggle. I haven't read as much as, say, you or some of my other colleagues. And so I feel a little behind the eight ball when I'm trying to suggest novels and topics and books because I have not read. I'm much further away from a lot of the titles that you guys just got done reading 10 years ago or 5 years ago.
Well, it's still, I mean, even then though, I mean, you say that, but I mean, there's been such a surplus of YA and mid-grade books, you know, the stuff our kids read over the last, you know, decade or less, like it's been very, fairly recent, like the surge. So the stuff the kids are reading now, I mean, it's just, it's everywhere. So it's hard. I mean, it takes time to find those books. I'm sorry for interrupting, but
no, you're fine. When I think of one little guy though, there's a kid, I'm not going to use names because I don't want to make anybody mad. But there's a little guy in the building that all of us know who is, you know, he's very different. The kid is very, very bright, and he says everything he thinks he has absolutely no filter. But I read a book, Counting by Sevens, and it was about this girl who is a genius, very, very smart, had no friends, latches on to one friend, loses her parents. Great book. And I couldn't wait to finish this book. And I was actually traveling with it a month or so ago. And I could not wait to get home to tell this kid, I found a book for you, man. I found your book.
Mm-hmm.
And true enough, he's reading the book and he loves the book. He's also got a couple others going, but, you know, he's peeling through this book and he loves it. So I think building the relationships, I can't suggest books to my kids if I don't even know what they like.
Yeah.
If I don't even know what they're into or, you know, what kind of maybe need needs to be met through an experience of some book that they're going to read.
You can't. It's like trying to tell someone what food they should eat and all you eat is hamburgers, right? Or, you know, it's like, well, it's some type of
not knowing their allergies. Like, I don't know this kid, I know his needs. He has verbalized, I have no friends, you know, or he acts like a freak half the time. So that's why the kid has no friends. But you know, he says completely outlandish things that are inappropriate and he needs to get sent out of the room half the time. But understanding that that's a need that needs to be met, that he needs to not feel like a freak because he hardly has any friends. This was a fabulous book of a girl who feels like a freak because she has no friends. And she learns the value of latching on to one person and being loyal to them and having an amazing friendship. And so, I don't know, if I didn't know that about him, if I didn't listen to all the crazy things he verbalizes, I wouldn't know that this was a great book for him. And it's feeding a need for him.
I mean, that's a fantastic point. I was just kind of like, the little lights were going off in my head. I thought I've really never had, well, sort of, because it's, you know, books and literature, you know, there are studies after studies that prove that kids that read become more compassionate adults. They become compassionate at their younger age. Kids that are read to them by their parents become more compassionate as they get older. It's because it forces you to understand the experiences of other people, right? I mean, that's the whole point of reading a story, is you see through their eyes. And for kids that don't have a lot of friends necessarily, or are real odd in their idiosyncrasies, you know, just people like bit weird mannerisms, literature is literally their door to other people. And yeah, I mean, it's fictional people, but that's going to improve those social skills. It's going to improve that without them having to sit awkwardly with a parent or a teacher, or some type of guardian going, okay, well, you know, you can't say those things out loud.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. I'm sitting here listening to us talk about books and I'm thinking, not everybody gets as jazzed about reading as we do. This is probably a completely boring podcast to most people. But in truth, the thing my heart's desire is to get these kids loving reading, not just for academic purposes and to be skilled and successful in their academics, which is crucial. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely, you know, imperative that they know how to read for all these other classes.
Yeah.
But I think of how much sadness and unhealthy lifestyles and all kinds of different things can be addressed through personal literature, different things, you know, that people read that nurture them and help them. You know, so I mean, my goal is for a kid to love reading, not just for academic purposes, but for their personal lives, to be lifelong readers, to be people that want to go home and they don't always flip a video game on, but they, you know, they read a book. I got one little guy. I got to tell one more story about books. I got one little guy that he didn't know what he wanted to read. Couldn't find a book. Well, he's a little bit of an athlete, and Jim Candy. I turned him on to this book. Can't even think of the author right
Everyone is obsessed with this book right now.
Well, because this kid read it, and he loved it. He's in sixth grade. It took him a month to read, but he persistently read every time we were in class. Then he started reading at home, and I said, man, you're getting through that book. And he said, yeah, my mom asked me, what are you doing? You got a project due or something? He's like, no, I just like this book. So it was so unusual for him to be reading at home that she literally kept asking, when is this due? What do you got to do to this? What do you have to do with this book? And he kept telling her, nothing. I'm just reading it. I love the book. And so it was pretty exciting to me that happened, that, you know, he didn't just read in class, but he read it. He's reading at home. And for our kids, and in many Title I schools, we don't have kids that are... The majority of the kids are not going to go home and pick up books at night and curl up with a book and read. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think about how I started reading. You know, when I was a kid, well, come on, let's face the fact, I'm the age that we didn't get a color TV till after I left home, okay? High school, I think my parents got a color TV.
Right.
But my mom used to always say, go curl up with a good book. I mean, that was always, you know, but we are in such competition with technology and video games and all this other stuff that distracts kids and takes away their attention that, you know, they don't always curl up with a book at home. But, and one of my pet peeves about, you know, Title I schools and even educators hearing them speak about people like parents don't care is so frustrating to me, because when we're in a Title I school, we have parents who are struggling financially and they maybe are working two jobs, you know, they may not be college educated. So they're working twice as many hours to pay bills, to keep a roof over the head. And it comes off like, you know, people, even educators say, oh, they don't care. They don't. And that's not the case at all, man. Yeah. They're in survival mode, you know.
Yeah.
So if we can't recognize that as educators within a Title I school with these kids who have these needs and try to get them to read as much as we can during the day and love on them and encourage them, you know, it's not in supplementing like bad parents. It's like encouraging and supporting parents who are surviving, man. You know,
doing your role in the village.
Yes, right? Absolutely, absolutely. But teachers that are in Title I schools don't recognize that. It's really sad to me. Like, oh, his parents don't even care. I can't get a hold of his parents. Yeah, they're working two jobs. They got their cell phone shut off because they chose to feed their kids and pay their rent, and so they couldn't pay their cell phone bill. I mean, you know, I don't know.
Well, and I mean,
I could go on and on about that, but
sure. I mean, well, I'm going to connect it to something else. So, you know. This is going to turn into a reading podcast or episode, which is fine. But my
that's what you get with two reading teachers. Sorry.
I know. I figured it was going to come up, but you know, the Title I thing, hitting on that point, and with reading and putting books in front of him, I feel, and well, I don't feel, I know that there's a lot of old school thinking when it comes to literature, and it's like teachers are these great demigods of literature, and we know all the great stuff to read. So you have to read, you know, Huck Finn at this young age, and you have to read, you know, what, pick your classic literature. Right, right. And yeah, those are great. You know, Twain's great, and Dickens is great, and you know, all of these writers are awesome. No one's doubting that. But if your goal is to create readers and to create kids with probably not of a lot of experience with reading, if you're trying to create those experiences so they keep doing it, putting those old school books is not the way to go 99% of the time.
Absolutely.
And controlling what they read, right? And this is our whole philosophy this year. Is
give them
the freedom to experiment with the text, get rid of the bad books that they're reading. You know, my whole thing, at the beginning of every class, if a kid comes in groaning because we're about to silently read for 15 minutes, I say to everyone, I go, if you are not looking forward to SSR, you're reading a crappy book, and you need to go put
you
it somewhere
the wrong
else.
Book. Absolutely.
And that doesn't mean it's a crappy book for everyone.
It just means it's not your book.
It's not. Go get. I was like, don't be bored. Like, the whole point of literature is to be engaged and involved, and it's hilarious because you give them that freedom, and we have kids reading this year.
Yeah,
way
amazing.
More than we've ever seen at
amazing.
This school.
And this is year 14 for me. You know, I didn't graduate from college. So I was 43, year 14 of teaching. Okay, do the math. Yeah, I'm getting old.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I have never seen kids.
I just said, like, I was just agreeing on how old you were.
You always have. Okay, and you know, one other thing I want to talk about in choice and text is we have to give kids, it is so important for us to give kids choices of text that they can relate to.
Yeah.
For example, I struggled at times when I have a large African-American community or a Hispanic community. If I cannot find kids who text that have authors that they can make personal connections to, I'm not doing my job.
Yeah.
I have got to find stuff that they can relate to, real-world stuff. Not that all these kids can't relate. It should interchange. They should all be reading books about all each other's cultures, all different things. But we have to make sure that we're providing a huge variety of diversity in authors, in text, so that our kids can make connections. And, you know, I want them to read about stuff that they can relate to.
Yeah,
so,
unintentional whitewashing. You know, it's like what they do when they take a classic Egyptian story in Hollywood and it's all white people.
Yeah.
And it's like, what? And, you know, and people, and that happens to literature too, because literature was, you know, it was controlled by a majority, and it's just now, like, even, like, authors now are struggling to, you know, they're trying to get, you know, more diverse authors and stuff like that. So you have to, it has to be a conscious choice.
Here's the other thing, Chastain. When we teach kids to read and we teach kids to write, it's reciprocal. They have to you have to write to be a good writer. You have to read to be a good reader. But if I want my kids to, you know, dream about being an author someday, I have to give them authors that they feel they have great mentors. Yes, this person did this. I can do this. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so that's why I think it's so important to just have all different kinds of things to offer our kids as far as text. And we are so rich in books this year. We are so lucky because our administrators spent some money on books for us. Our kids have a huge opportunity to pick up any book they want to read.
So and, you know, there's a great book. I don't remember. I'm going to quote it, but I don't remember who said it. But he goes, you know, they were asking about getting books in schools. And it was like, you know, what if you're at a school that doesn't have a lot of money? And it's like, well, you know, you need to ask because administrators can find money for books. Usually that's one of the easier things administrators can find money for. And then, you know, the question came up to this guy. He goes, They go, well, what if my administrator just absolutely refuses? Like, we're not going to do book study, or not even book study, we're not going to have books in classrooms. You know, libraries are shrinking, you know, all across the United States. Yes. They're not librarians anymore. They're tech people, which is like blasphemy in my eyes.
I know, absolutely.
But it's the changing environment. And they're like, what if you're in this environment where it's just not a book rich and they don't want to do this? They just want to do sample texts and stuff. And the guy just responded, he goes, leave the school, right? Go somewhere else. If you're at a place
that doesn't value reading, yes.
Then go somewhere else. And I mean, that's a harsh thing to say, but I couldn't imagine not being at this school because I have a whole bookshelf over here that's filled with books.
It's amazing.
And they came from having that push at the end of last year to this year is we're going to tackle
and
this
Kate
beast.
Nelson, we got to throw a shout out to Kate Nelson. Yeah. You know, Whitfield brought her in as a consultant for us, and she challenged us with the reading, and she really turned us on to the Book Whisper and some of those, you know, things that just got us motivated, got us excited.
So to bring this back a little bit to the ELL population and your, you know, those special classes, you know, when it comes to, you know, a lot of them are just struggling, you know, you have a lot of kids that are struggling with alphabet, right? I mean, you got
Not a lot, but there's a few kids, there's a handful of kids that they're struggling with that. They've only been in the country 1 year, you know, and here's the thing that
this is happening all across the United States, especially with all the refugee like crisis everywhere.
Everything that's going on, but we have to understand that. And that's why it's hard when, you know, old school folks are like, oh, if you're going to be in America, you got to speak English, you know. First of all, what I get frustrated with is we are all immigrants, okay? Yeah. Unless you're a Native American, like, your family came from somewhere, okay? My dad's side all came from Sweden. I mean, everybody came from somewhere. Language acquisition doesn't happen overnight. And, you know, I'm not even talking about the whole citizenship and you know, all that kind of thing. I'm just talking about speaking a new language.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen overnight. But the newcomer kids, they're the ones that struggle mostly with the alphabet. I'm not going to say all of them do because of the kids that I have. I actually have enrichment, and that's the kids who spent 1 year in newcomers or they were in elementary bilingual classes. And so most of the kids I get, it's their second year in the States. So they have most of them. I only have a couple that are much lower and don't, you know, they are struggling. And so that's a challenge at times to differentiate within the classroom, different levels with a workshop type atmosphere so that I've got somebody working on this over here and work with this over here. One of the things that I do, now my first class, it's mostly Spanish speaking. It's all Spanish speaking kids. But my third, you know, the second class I have, third period, I have kids that I can pair them up, one that speaks Arabic, one that speaks Spanish. So they have to speak English to help each other out and work on whatever they're working on. So, yeah, you know, and the key is just figuring out where is each kid at and backing it up. If the one kid needs more work with that and they have to work at a preschool level with the reading, we back it up, we get them that stuff and build the foundation again. So, and it's a struggle at times because a lot of times your behavior issues come from that. And this one little guy we're talking about, you and I both have him, you know, when it's easier to be funny and misbehaving than to look stupid.
Yeah.
So when kids feel lost and kids feel like they're not, you know, at pace with everybody else, sometimes it's much easier to act a fool and be funny or, you know, act angry than it is to say, I'm lost. I need help. And so I think that's something we got to recognize too.
You know what's interesting is this is not off topic, but it's something from my personal life. But it was like thinking back to the history of my family and whatnot, and about, you know, middle school is really vague to me because that was when like everything collapsed in my home life. You know, mom and dad were getting a divorce. Like it was like bad thing after one another or whatnot. So I barely remember that time. But the one thing I do remember is that was the one time in school where I was the funny kid. Right? I was the one sitting there, you know, cracking the jokes. And teachers didn't hate me. I never was in trouble. I never went to the principal's office. Right. I didn't get sent to the principal's office until I was in high school, and that was because I was a butthole. But I kind of deserved
that
one.
Imagine
that. Yeah. But, you know, in middle school, I strictly remember that. And that, it's just really interesting, like, being in a middle school now. And that's, you know, that's only where I've taught. Is just, you know, seeing those kids and being able to point them out and being like, man, I get you. I don't understand what's happening. I have no idea. It could be something small, it could be something big, right. But it's like, it's so weird how that's totally true. And it's with the emotional stuff too. With literature, we deal with emotional topics, you know, big and small and whatnot. And the kids that, you know, have had emotional things go happen, a lot of them resent that, and they don't want to dive into it. And they're the ones that make a joke about, oh, you know, this poem's sad or whatever, you know, and they make fun of that stuff. And it's like, I got you, right?
Yeah.
It's weird how that comes up. But I want to ask you, right? So I want you to think about, like, your experience and everything that you've learned from just being everywhere. You know, a lot of teachers are new, right? You know, a lot of districts are, you know, we're getting, you know, a lot of things are changing, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of this is going on. What would you be your advice to? First, I want your advice to someone who might be resisting change, because schools are changing across America, whether they want to or not. Mm-hmm. Like, things are happening, and they always have, but it feels like we're in a almost an existential crisis to some extent on some levels, because it's like, you know, new studies are coming out, things are changing, philosophies are changing, and I've watched you personally go, oh well, you know, this isn't how I used to do it, but I'm jumping in.
Right.
So, like, a teacher like you who might be experiencing that, but they don't really know how to handle the change. What would be your advice to someone like that? Someone who's been in the game for a while.
You know, it's funny because I came in the game at like 43, but I
hip lingo on teacher.
And I worked with people who had been teaching already 20 years when I, you know, met them. And every time we would do a new, you know, professional development, like, you know how it is. There's people moaning and groaning, and I'm not trying that. And in all fairness, sometimes there's a lot of stuff that it feels like the pendulum swings. Okay, we're going this way. We're going to do this because we think this is the most effective strategy we can do. And then the pendulum swings. No, that's not what we're going to do. We're going to do complete opposite. So there are times when it's frustrating because it is just, you know, but let's just say that at least they're pursuing, how are we going to serve these kids, you know? So I've been fortunate that when I have to attribute a lot of it that I've worked with a lot of young people. I have never had a problem with young folks being in leadership over me or, you know, directing me. And I have worked with some amazing people with new innovative ideas or coming out of college. And I feel like I've seen it as a real plus, you know, that they have stuff to show me, you know, that I've learned that. Number one, technology. I didn't grow up in the technology age. So you laugh at me sometimes and we get frustrated. But when you did not grow up in that, you know, I know a lot of people my age or even younger or older and gone out of the field who resisted that so much because they just didn't, you know, they didn't get it. And I've learned a whole lot more. You think I'm an idiot now. I used to really be an idiot. But I don't know. I am thrilled with being open to change because in the end of the day, it's about servicing the kid. It's about servicing students. And hopefully, we are really blessed because we're with an administrative staff that if they saw that something did not service the kids, that's their first priority. That is our principal's first priority, is servicing the students. So I'm going to trust what the guy tells me. I mean, I really think that we're in a position where we're very lucky because we have a really wise administrator. I'm not just sucking up in case he listens to this. But, you know, we all feel it. We all know it, man. Yeah. Everybody on this, I don't know really anybody who doesn't feel really positive about being here. Like, no one wanted out of here last year because our administrators have our kids' best interest in mind, and they have our interest in mind. They give us every bit of support to be what they expect us to be. So I'm open to new ideas because the other thing I love about this, just, I don't know if it's the district because I'm new, it's my second year, but there's no gotcha mentality. So if you're coming at me with professional development and new ideas and you don't have a gotcha mentality, like if you screw this up, I got you, but you have a, look, you're really strong here, we want you to do this and let's help you get stronger in this one. Let's see if you can do this direction or do this. So I don't know. I think it's really, really easy to be open. I haven't always worked with administrators who are that supportive and that amazing to create an atmosphere that it's a win-win for everybody, teachers and students, you know. I think it's a lot easier to be open when you feel the support and you don't feel any threat. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I don't know if I answered your question, but
yeah,
dude, I get so bored with my own ideas that there's days I wouldn't want my dog in my own classroom, okay? So it's like I have to be open to what else is out there, you know? And I mean, I think the hugest compliment is to steal from teachers, you know? How many times have I seen you do something? I'm like, Chastain, give me that. Yeah, I'm going to go do that. You know, it's just what we should do. Is listen to each other, work with each other, be open.
Yeah. I mean, well, there's the advice right there. I mean, if you're feeling the change, feeling the pressure, it's like, just stop pushing back.
No kidding.
Let it happen.
Yeah, no kidding. But I think it comes from a feeling of inadequacy at times. Like, hey, yeah. I haven't experienced that. Here's what I do know. Whether it's good, bad, or ugly, and I'm not getting the results, at least I know it. At least I do this, you know. And I think that's what people I've worked with, that's been their feeling. Like, I remember, you know, working with people 10 years ago. I went in and they had a big long table and they weren't even copy machine sheets. They were doggone like mimeograph sheets. Like, they look purple still, half of them or something. But, you know, it's just that fear, and I don't know.
Yeah, I think fear is the biggest driver of people not adapting to their surroundings. It's not that they don't care about the kids. It's that they don't love their job. It's like, no one wants to feel dumb.
Yeah, but that's where this administration is amazing, because they offer enough support where you don't have to feel the fear. And I came in here at the beginning of the year constantly feeling the fear. Mm-hmm. And Bowles kept telling me, man, relax. You know, Keisha kept telling me, nobody's coming looking for you, you know, to see if you marked your, you know, dotted your I's and crossed your T's. Just dig in. Just start doing this stuff. Nobody's going to come after you, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it took me a while, man. It took me, I'd say it took a whole semester for me. I was crying every few weeks. You remember that.
You know what? The thing we talk about the most on this podcast is relationship building and crying. I swear, we talk about crying all the time.
I'm good at both of those, man. I'm so good at those.
It's the crying podcast. You know what? People listen to this, and I know they're just nodding their heads like, yep.
Yeah, especially the ones that know me. Oh, my, you know, one of my stepdaughters, Alex. Oh, Marsha cried? Big surprise. Yeah, she's crying? Oh, my God. I mean, it doesn't take much, but anyway.
That's hilarious. So, okay. We gave their advice to the experienced vets, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, what about someone walking in? What about someone who's fairly new? A year, maybe they're fresh out of college. Maybe they're, you know, they're like me, you know, they've been teaching a few years and whatnot. What do you tell them, especially if they're working in an environment that may be different than where they went to school, or an environment that's so filled with different cultures that they feel like a fish out of water? How would you tell someone to handle that at a young age?
I think one of the biggest struggles as a new teacher is classroom management. And I struggled for years. I know I struggled for years. Initially in my, and there's that, you know, constant thought of, I'm going to write you a referral.
Yeah.
You know, and there's got to be a better way. There's a better way. And it is building relationships. But one of the things that, one old gal, when I was, honestly, it was 14 years ago when I was going through some training, one old gal taught me this principle called second chance. And we can't front kids in front of everybody, because it's never going to work.
Yeah.
You know, so if I got an issue with a kid and I really need to deal with something, I'm not saying I'm successful at this all the time, but the most successful thing I can do is pull them out of the room, look at them and go, man, I don't know what's up with you, but you're just at it. Did you start out with a bad morning? Was it a bad day at your house? And 9 times out of 10, a kid will start crying and tell me, yeah, my mom screamed at me all the way in the car, blah, 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 blah. And I don't even care what it is. If it's something that I can excuse, even if it's an F-bomb, even if it's something that I can excuse by having a conversation and take out there and say, you know what, I'm going to give you a second chance, because I really don't think that's who you are. So I'm going to give you a second chance, but I'm telling you, don't do this to me again. Now, can we agree that if I give you a chance to just do this all over and start your day all over, can you pull it together? And they're like, yes, yes, I can. And I cannot even tell you how many kids' trust I've gained from doing that, from not writing them up, from not, you know, doing whatever. But the other thing is I've learned, and it's only been the last few years, is parent communication, especially at Barnett. The parents were amazing. It was a Title I school, very diverse. But I did not write many referrals. I wrote referrals for blatant, really bad things that you got to write a referral for.
Yeah.
But like all the classroom management stuff, man, I just got on the phone. And folks want to help with your kids. And they want to avoid the office. And they want to avoid principal intervention and all that stuff. And the principals sure want you to avoid that. They got enough crap to do, you know. Mm-hmm. So I would call parents and just say, look, I'm having a lot of trouble. First, yeah, you know, I'd start with a positive thing, like, I love having your kid in class. You know, there's some good things. I got to think of a good thing of everybody before you start out. And just say, I'm really struggling. Can you help me understand why they might be doing whatever. Can you help me understand? Can you help me with this? Can you help me handle this? Can we do this without getting the office involved? Man, parents want that. They totally want that. And then the other thing is, and they'll come. They'll come sit in class. They'll come walk their kid up and down the halls if they can get away from work. But they will come up, you know, and they will talk to their kid. And they you know, I've had people tell me, oh, Miss Smithy, you will see a new child tomorrow, you know. I mean, I had amazing appearance at Barnett. And, you know, you talk about the differences. Honestly, at the Title I school at Barnett, I felt like I had a whole lot more parent support with parents who were willing to say, yeah, my kid screwed up and I'm going to handle it. Where at the other school, it wasn't quite so much that, yeah, my kid screwed up. It was like, well, I've never seen my child do that, so I'm going to come up there and figure out what's going on, you know, so... Very interesting difference, but...
You know, it's funny about that, not to go off on a tangent, but the, you know, everything, every teacher's seen those memes where it's like, you know, used to when a, back in the day, they always say, you know, when a kid got in trouble, it was the kid's fault.
Right.
And, you know, modern times, they always say kids get in trouble and it's the teacher's fault.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it's probably unfair, because I don't think that, like you said, like, it probably depends on where you're at, what's the dynamic of the school, and, like, what the expectations are. Because if, like, the expectations are clear to not only you, the student, the principal, and the parent, like, I don't think you're going to have that, you know, that flip
right,
around.
Right. The other thing I really, honestly, is positive phone calls, man.
Yeah.
I have called parents and just told them, thank you for, you know, sending me this kid. What a great kid. And when I need to make another phone call where it's not so great, they are so much more open, you know, to being helpful. So that's another thing. But... I don't know. I just think, you know, I get all over kids in my classroom. I'm trying to do our Capturing Kids' Hearts strategies, but there's some times where I just go granny on them and they know better, you know, so they just pull it together.
Yeah. That's a skill. I wish I had the granny skill.
Well, you ain't a granny, so it doesn't work, you know.
I know.
It's funny because I'm older. I am as old as some of these kids' grandmas, and so they'll say to me, Miss Smithy, you're like another grandma to me. And I'm realizing it's a compliment, but, you know, at the time, I'm like, doggone. She's telling me I'm her mother's age, which I am, some of these kids. So, but I don't know. I would say writing referrals less, but talking to parents, really and truly talking to parents.
Yeah, don't be afraid to call.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I cannot tell you how many parents I've apologized to. Like, if they've been unhappy, I got to be willing to admit where I've fallen or where I haven't been as supportive or whatever. I just had that with a student 2 weeks ago, you know. The mom was ticked. She didn't want to talk to me. She didn't want to talk to anybody. And I said to her, you know, I said, I just want to make an amends to you. I want to tell you I'm sorry that you feel like you haven't been heard, and I want to ask your forgiveness. I mean, parents are probably picking themselves off the floor, you know, and they're like, wow, thinking, okay. But I screw up, man. Yeah. I make mistakes. And I've apologized to kids in the classroom. I've apologized to parents when I need to. And just, you know, saying, hey, let's start over. Thank you for helping me become a better teacher. You know, it's not easy, man. And I usually cry when that happens, too. But and it's not like it happens
It's not
all
easy
time.
To admit, like, because, I mean, this is your space. And sometimes you screw up in your space. It's really hard to admit that.
Yes. And one thing I think, you know, having four kids of my own and having raised them and having to make education choices for my kids all the way along up and having issues where they've had trouble at school or whatever, I don't know, it gives me a little bit of an edge to know the stress and strain parents are under, because parents, that's one of the hugest things they stay awake at night about, man, is trying to figure out what school their kids should be at, what class they should take. You know, are they acting up at school? What are they doing? And so I have that heart that I've walked that road.
We're going to bring it to a close.
Okay.
Miss Smithy, you were a rock star. I just want you to know that. You helped a lot of people today.
Thank you.
And they're sitting there just nodding, taking notes.
Nodding, falling asleep. Hopefully they made it through this podcast.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah. Well, Miss Johnson, she always, or Mrs. Johnson, she listens to hers when she's driving. So hopefully it's keeping her awake while she's driving. She's listening to this now.
Don't hit that. Don't go off the highway, Johnson.
Anyway, for everyone listening.
Well, I just want to say something before we end.
Go ahead.
I want to say how proud I am. You know I'm very proud of you in the podcast and what an amazing job you do. You know that I think I work with somebody who's completely brilliant and has read stuff that I couldn't even carry in my backpack, okay? But You annoy the heck out of me some days, but the majority of the time I just highly respect you and I love working with you. And, it's a great challenge and encouragement to be with you. And we laugh ourselves like sick sometimes. So that's really a plus too.
That's how this podcast started. Yeah. That's how this episode started.
Yeah. We had to start over four times.
Thank you
for having me. What a privilege. And I feel humbled. And, I just felt like I listened to all my colleagues in these, and I frankly don't know that I had anything that I could say that would come up to par with some of the amazing advice that I've taken from some of I've heard. But keep it up, man. You're doing a great job.
I appreciate it. You know, it's awkward for me to take compliments, so I'm just going to say thank you.
I'm really proud of you. You're doing a great job.
I do appreciate it. The work of Teach Me Teacher, for everyone who knows, everyone who listens, you know, it's a labor of love for me. So it's not, you know, I do it to do it.
Can I have that $50 back that you pay to do this?
We're still learning how to use that. For everyone else listening, I need you to go teachmeteacherpodcast.com where you can get all the episodes. Like, comment, subscribe. Follow us on Facebook where we post everything. Follow us, subscribe really on iTunes or whatever podcast thing you do. It really helps. Drop a review. We haven't had a review in a while on iTunes.
Please don't make me cry.
Those reviews on iTunes really, it helps the podcast spread. So if you have time, go to iTunes, drop that review there. It helps us, helps all of us, helps the word spread. So anyway, thank you for listening. I really do appreciate it. And remember, share this with your team. Have a good one.